Coming to you live from the Jella Caves, I'm Tom Rich, and with me as always are terrible boys and beasts, and this is the Mildly Alarming Podcast. Episode 2, The Child on the Tricycle.
Welcome back to the Mildly Alarming Podcast, the podcast other podcasts listen to feel better about themselves. I'm Johannes Stauffer.
And I'm Shame. But you could call me Tom. Rich.
Okay, Shame. Shane?
No,
is your name Shane?
It's Shame, like Shame Moo, that
Shame Moo.
Yeah, that cow they had at SeaWorld that was so bad at being a
That cow they had at SeaWorld.
Yeah, you know, it was big, it lived in the water. Didn't have any horns.
Was it bad at being a cow? Is that where you were going with that?
It was bad at being something.
Shamu.
Yeah.
Incredible.
You know, I do try.
Should make a Shamu t-shirt along with the Spite Narwhal t-shirt that I haven't made yet either. Because I'm not an artist.
We should do a lot of things in life.
Like make money. Or really accomplish anything.
We accomplish something.
Shame.
Right.
Yeah. So this week we're talking about a game we've mentioned on the air before. But it's great, and you should play it, and we're going to tell you why, and it is called Gravwell.
Well, now you've blown the ending of the segment, the review of Gravwell.
No, that's this is the beginning of what?
You've blown the ending. If you already tell them, we're going to tell them it's great. That's it. That's the whole review.
Oh, I see. I thought you were saying I was ruining the ending of the segment by saying what it was, because the last several segments, we have spent two-thirds of that segment talking about something other than the actual topic.
That's a fair point. No, I was saying you gotta save something for the end of the review, like the score that you're giving it.
I could be lying. You never know.
We're also debuting our revolutionary new Mildly Alarming scoring system, where we score games from a scale of I got nothing. I thought I had somewhere to go with that, and I lost it.
And yet it is still less confusing than Gary Smulehan's game rating system, which is an arbitrary and logarithmic sea turtle based scale that no one seems to understand but him. I should have made a loggerhead logarithmic joke there, but I missed it.
Is why I don't understand what a lumberjack's cranium has to do with anything.
Isn't there a loggerhead turtle? Is it loggerhead? There's a something head turtle.
I think so.
Okay.
This is a complete train wreck.
It's terrible.
Gravwell is a game made by a company that I forget, and we didn't grab the box to have it in front of us.
You
know,
you have a computer right in front of you. You could look it up.
It's looking up recipes for crepes.
It can only do one thing at a time.
Have you ever tried to look up crepe recipes?
I haven't.
It takes a lot of computing cycles.
Wow. Okay. All right.
But anyway, Gravwell is a game about being in a spaceship and trying to escape from, I think it's the ninth dimension.
I think that's the name of the game editing, right?
Yeah, and you're in the ninth dimension. You got to get out. So you start out in the middle of the board in a singularity. There's a spiraling path leading outward to a, what do you call it? A warp gate at the end. And you and your buddies are going to try to escape. You're going to have a hand of cards, which you acquire through a mechanic we'll talk about a little bit later on because it's kind of cool. You're going to have a hand of cards, and you're going to each play one simultaneously, reveal them. Each card has a letter on it, and they resolve in alphabetical order. So whoever played an A would go first, followed by B, C, D, E, and all the way up to Z. And then they're going to tell you how far you move along the path. What is kind of innovative and neat about the game, though, is that which direction you move along the path is determined by whether the card is pulling you toward or away from the nearest object.
Yeah.
So which direction you move is both... depends on whether or not you are going to move toward that thing or be pushed off of it, and where that object is. So if you've got somebody one space in front of you and you pull a pull toward card on them, you'll move however many spaces the card indicates forward along the track. Mm-hmm. But if that same you play that same card and the nearest object is one space behind you, you go backwards toward the singularity instead.
And an object can be another player's ship, or there are also a couple of derelict ships just floating in the void.
So you have to carefully guess, or you have to first look at what the situation on the board is and what you're, what will get you moving forward fast enough, but you also have to guess whether or not the other players are going to put down a card that will have them act before you and therefore move their ship and thus completely screw up your plans. So, for example, if I play a move me forward 7 by pulling toward the nearest object card, and Johannes is right in front of me, but he pulls toward me and moves behind me before I get to go, all of a sudden I'm slingshotting myself way back, all the way back toward the beginning.
There's also a pretty cool mechanic called the... What is it? It's just the stop card?
Emergency stop.
Emergency stop.
Yep.
Which you can play, depending on the variant, in the basic game, you can play it once per round to stop. So a round takes, is it 5 cards?
I don't remember how many
cards. I think it's 5 cards in your hand. You can basically use your emergency stop card to negate one of those if it doesn't work out the way you planned. But then once you've used it, you've used it. There's another, a harder variant of the game where you get to use your emergency stop once per game.
Yep. There's also a third type of card that, instead of moving you, pulls everything toward you. So it moves everybody else's ships and all the derelicts toward you on the path instead of pushing on or moving you around. Which is a tracker beam card. Yeah, which feels strategic. I've never mastered when to use it and when not to. I have no idea how it's supposed to work. But
I've been able to use it about as strategically as I've been able to use any other card.
Sure.
But at the point when at the point when you generally most want to use it, you're usually way behind, and it's just a screw you to everyone else.
Sure.
Because you just want to drag them back a ways.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be used a little more strategically. You could drop it. Say you're in a position where you only have... Well, no, even that would be hard to do, because you wouldn't be able to play your next card until the next turn. Well, mm-hmm. It could still work. If someone's ahead of you, but you only have repulsor cards and the tractor beam card... Yeah. You could use it to get them behind you so that you can then push forward off of them on the next turn, provided everything continues to work out your way, which it generally doesn't.
It doesn't. It doesn't work out that way at all. You can probably tell, we really like Gravwell. We enjoy it a lot. There's one more mechanic we got to go over, right? The drafting. So at the beginning of each round, the cards are dealt out in a number of piles based on the number of players. The piles are of 2 cards, 1 face down and 1 face up. And you go around in turn order selecting one pile to add to your hand.
Until they're all gone.
So you know about half of the cards you're going to get when you draft, and then you're getting half of them as mystery cards.
Yeah, and you won't be able to work out what everyone has either, because I think even in the largest game, you still end up leaving a few cards.
There's more cards than you'll ever deal out into the draft pile. So you're always got that little bit of mystery there. You can make some educated guesses.
Mm-hmm.
It is indicated on the board how many cards of each type there are.
No, there's only 1 card of each type. That indicates what power they move.
There's only one of each letter.
There's only one of each card type.
Do we have this argument, this conversation
every time we play?
Every single time we play?
There's a nice little handy thing, because they're alphabetical, but they're using chemical symbols from the from the. I think they are all real chemical symbols from the periodic table, and there's a little chart on both sides of the board showing you all of the cards alphabetically. With a little bar telling within their color to tell if it's a repulsor, an attractor, I guess you'd call it,
sure.
or a tractor beam. And then that bar is a certain height, like in a bar graph, and that tells you how powerful it is, not how many of them there are.
Okay.
There's actually only 1 of each card.
Now I know that.
Yeah. Again.
For the second time.
By the way, the game is published by Cryptozoic Entertainment and Renegade Game Studios.
Gotcha.
And the designer is Corey Young, who we are going to have on the show in the next segment.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Super exciting.
I wish I had worn pants.
It's via Skype, so as long as you sit, he shouldn't know that you're not wearing pants.
He's going to know.
He'll know.
I'm going to tell him all about it.
Okay. Great.
In detail. Which really will boil down to, I'm not wearing pants. That's really all there is to say about that. Anyway.
I don't know if he knew what he was getting himself into when he
agreed to be on this podcast. Did he listen to any episodes?
I sincerely doubt it. I talked to him on Twitter, and we had a nice conversation.
And then he was like, I want to be on your show?
Well, no, I asked him if he would like to be.
Okay. You're so much better at this podcasting thing than I am.
That is true.
Gravwell. So, we like Gravwell, obviously. I think that's come through here. What about it jumps out to you as a positive that makes you all hot and bothered over it?
Well, I liked it mechanically. I like the movement relative to other players rather mm-hmm. than relative to a static board and how all that stuff can change. When I picked it up at the store and looked at it, we looked at it a couple times before we bought it, but not that many times. There are a lot of games we go to the store and we pick up a game and we're like, we should probably get this one day, but I don't know how many of our friends are going to like it or if it's going to... I think we looked at it like one other time and then we're like, yes, this is the thing we're buying. Mm-hmm. I really like it thematically. It's in spaceships, mm-hmm. in the ninth dimension. Like, the whole thing is interesting. But mechanically, it's intriguing. It's unique and original. I've never seen another game that does anything really very similar to mm-hmm. it at all. And it's pretty light. It's not light like a party game is light. It doesn't feel like too easy to ignore.
Sure.
There's strategy and stuff, but it plays pretty quickly and it's pretty contained. You know, it doesn't have a million errata and exceptions to the rules and mm-hmm. stuff. It's pretty easy to teach and pretty easy to grasp. Mm-hmm. I like it.
Yeah, I would agree that the thing that really jumps out about it is that core of moving relative to where the other players are and how that impacts your strategy. Because you're thinking, how important is it that this card go off exactly as I want it to? How important is it that I go before Gary so that I'm pulling toward him and we'll get to slingshot? Versus how important is it that I move, you know, 7 as compared to 2 spaces? Because mm-hmm. sometimes you'll be choosing between 2 things that will both move you forward. One will move you 2 but go very early in the rotation. One will move you a lot but go a lot later. And you got to balance it. There's some cool risk stuff going on there. There's some cool reading of what other players are doing and guessing about what they have done. Because even though you don't have perfect info about what cards were dealt out in the spread, mm-hmm. you can make some educated guesses about what's left, especially if you remember that there's only one of each card.
Yeah.
And that's good. That's good. I like it. So I also, yeah, as you're saying too, it's great. Greatly simple to teach, like mm-hmm. doesn't take very long at all. Easy to explain. Everybody gets it right away.
I don't know that we've looked at the rule book since the first.
I
don't think there's ever been. I don't know. Let me check the rules. Yeah. See what it says about that.
And it's quick to play too. It doesn't take more than, I would say, 20 minutes.
Yeah. And usually we play it and everyone wants to play again. It's not mm-hmm. like, all right, we've done that. Now let's do something else.
Right.
It's pretty fun and engaging.
I find that it's a good first game of the night type of game. Mm-hmm. Where everybody's got there, you sit down, you got your first beverages, you got your chips and guac out, and that's how you pronounce that, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And everybody go. You go.
It's actually, chips and guac.
You go a couple of rounds.
It's so gross.
Okay. You go around a couple of rounds, and then you get onto the bigger, heavier stuff. Mm-hmm. After that, though, the more convoluted things. It does work.
Yeah, I look at it, and I always think, there's so many expansions I could make for this game. And then I think there's probably a reason there aren't expansions for this game.
Yeah.
But I like it.
We should ask, what's his name?
Corey.
Oh, I was going to call him Chip.
Yeah, that's the other guy we interviewed.
Yeah. So I was going to ask, we should ask Chip if he's got any expansions in the pipe for it.
Like, and Chip would be like, why would I have expansions in the pipe?
And why are you calling me Chip?
I was going to say, if we were actually asking Chip. You know, why would I have expansions in the pipe for Corey's game?
Do you think they're friends?
I don't know.
Do you think they like go and get chocolate malts together?
They live in different states.
They could still get chocolate malts together.
They just have to drive
away. Yeah, it's just they have to plan ahead, budget a little bit for it.
Yeah. Sure. Let's just stick with that mythology.
Can we ask him if he's friends with Chip?
You're welcome to. I'm not going to. Thanks for being on the podcast, Mr. Young. We were wondering, first off, we know you designed Gravwell and it's been fairly successful. And I had a lot of questions for you about designing as a person who's colorblind. But our first question here is, are you friends with Chip Beauvais? And if not, why not? And if so, do you get chocolate malts together? Welcome to the Mildly Alarming Podcast.
Hello? Hello? You there? He hung up.
Well,
that's what I got to say about Gravwell. It's good. It's really good. I highly recommend it.
Are there things it could do better?
Do we really want to pee in the guy's Wheaties right before he comes on the show?
Yeah. Why okay. not? You shouldn't be eating Wheaties this late at night anyway.
No, it's 100%
breakfast cereal.
It's 100% perfect.
Wow.
I feel like there should be more than one copy of each card.
Yeah? I wonder, we should ask him about that. I wonder how much that would change the
math
probability. Yeah.
If I had to change something about Gravwell, there's still a good deal of player interaction in that, you know, you can do stuff to another. I guess if I were going to, I guess for what it is, there's not much you could change while keeping it as simple and light as it is.
Right,
anything you're going to do is going to add more. If I were going to explore somewhere, another area of design and see where I could go with it, I would look for ways to directly influence the other player's ships. Cards that let you, I don't know, zap a card out of their hand, mm-hmm. or cards that let you give up your move this time to draw an extra pile next time or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
That kind of goofiness. I don't know that it would add much or be that interesting, but that's the obvious place I would want to go on it.
I like the theme so much, I would want to see more done with it. Like, how did you get there? What else is mm-hmm. there? What goes on in the ninth dimension? And I'd like to see the derelicts do more or different things.
Yeah.
If one of them randomly, like maybe printed on the bottom of the base or something, had it exploded or something, mm-hmm. if you got too close to it, you know, that kind of thing where there's a little bit, you don't have to play with it in there, but you, so it's not game changing, but it's stuff you could add on mm-hmm. once you've played the game enough times.
Maybe spaces along the path that if you land directly on them, they do something.
Yeah.
Give you a resource, an extra resource, or let you block movement or something like that.
Yeah. And I don't think the game needs any of those things. I think it is good the way it is, mm-hmm. but I think that could be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I would do.
Do you know of any other games that do use the move relative to others kind of mechanic?
No. It seems pretty unique to me.
I like it and I want to do things with it, but I don't want to just be ripping off Gravwell.
We can do that. That's fine.
It's probably fine.
He came on the show. That gave us...
That gives us express permission to do whatever we want.
Yeah, it gives us full access. IP. Yeah, full access. It's actually true. It's in the contract he signed.
I forgot to have him sign the contract.
It's okay. I went into his house while he was sleeping and used his hand to sign it.
Wow. All right. That's commitment.
I'm nothing if not dedicated.
Sure.
Man, you know, we're recording this before he's called. He's really going to be in for a surprise when he listens to the show.
If he listens to the show.
I wouldn't listen to the show.
I don't listen to That's not true. I do.
You listen to the show like four times.
I do. I listen to it too many times.
It's not a very good show.
It's okay. Sometimes. One time we had that Gabo on here.
Something called a Gabo.
yeah. All right. Well, I guess we'll be back shortly with the interview portion.
With a vampire?
With a vampire. He might be a vampire. Maybe that's why he's colorblind. Are vampires colorblind?
Well, they don't cast shadows. No, reflections.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe they're colorblind.
Thus, they are colorblind.
Yes, that's how that works. Can we ask if he's a vampire?
You're welcome to ask if he's a vampire.
He's not going to want to come back, is he?
He's not going to want to have been here in the first place.
Success.
Well,
if Twitter
at mildly alarming
and email show a mildly alarming mail.com.
That's not even a little bit right. We're on Twitter at mildly alarming.
We're on email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
And we are on the webernets with our very own site of the web variety at www.mildlyalarming.com.
We're also inside your mouth, so we'll hear it when you talk.
It's really dark and moist in here. We'll be right back.
Okay, bye. Sorry. Just snapping a quick selfie here, you know, from my FaceTweet scroll feed. But you know what's always disappointed me? When I eat a big fistful of garlic and licorice, but my internet friends don't know it because they can't smell my putrid mouth. That's why I got the new Smelfie-equipped Gunchlin AstroTech 38Q Cleverphone. You heard me right, Smelfie technology. These new phones will sample and record your funk so that when your friends look at your photos using compatible hardware, they'll get a hot blast of whatever you smelled like right in their faces. Buying cologne? They'll smell it. Snapping that post-marathon victory shot? It'll be like your friends are right up inside your armpits. Getting an abscess drained? Snap a pic and let your friends experience every nasty, reeking whiff. Head on down to your Gunstorm Wireless store and ask about trading up to a smelfy-capable phone today.
Welcome back to the Mildly Alarming Podcast. I'm Johannes Stauffer.
And I'm Tom Rich.
And with us now we have Corey Young, designer of Gravwell, the game that we reviewed in the previous segment. Hi, Corey.
Hi. Good to talk to you guys.
You
too. I really hope that went well.
I think it did.
All positive stuff.
It's actually funny. I'm sure you'll hear it if you choose to listen to the episode when it goes up. But we did our review. We really liked it, and we were really short on time. And we went, Do you have anything bad to say? Like anything you'd change about the game? And we're like, no. Here's a few ideas we might try, but it's probably better without them.
Well, I appreciate your editing there. That's good.
So, I've run into you a few times on Twitter and just last week or earlier this last week, it was last week, ended up having a brief impromptu little conversation with you about, designing for the colorblind and as a person who is colorblind. And, Corey very generously agreed to be a guest on our podcast, and we're really excited to have him. So, we're going to dive right in, for those of you who listen to the first half, which is probably all of you listening, you know how we feel about Gravwell. And so we were just wondering if you could walk us through, because this is the one game you have out right now, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
If you could walk us through what inspired you to design, what got you into game design, and what got you to Gravwell initially in the first place, and just kind of the steps you took to get it to where it is today.
Sure. Well, you only have 40 minutes, so this might take a little while.
Sure.
I'll give you the short part. I've tinkered with games for a long time. I used to play the games you'd find in Dragon magazine back in the 80s. And I was a fan of Tom Wham's work and a few others. And I started just kind of playing around with the fringes of other people's games and making variants of other people's games. A lot of Steve Jackson games at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was just tinkering around with them for my own fun and with my friends, with no idea of, or no thought of publishing anything. And then about 8 years ago, I started thinking about it again, getting back into the hobby. The first game I designed was actually I wanted to do a replacement for Steve Jackson's Hacker game. They still publish the same Hacker game that they published back in the 80s, and it still features dial-ups and modems and things like that. So the
a board game? I've played Hacker as a PC game.
It was a reskinned version of Illuminati, the Steve Jackson Illuminati game. So it was a card game, but you built a network of cards, and you had dial-ups, and you'd get into one place and get root, and so on. But I designed a game that played quite a bit differently than that, and I got them. I sent them a letter, asked them to have a look at it. And they were so gracious, so so kind about it, and welcoming. And I got a rejection letter from them, but it was the nicest rejection letter a nicer one than I'd ever expected. And it showed that they had clearly spent time playing the game, and they gave very good, sound feedback, about this worked and this didn't work and so on, That kind of lit my fire. It said, okay, well, I can design something that they like, so let's see what else I can do. And then over the course of the next several years, I designed a number of games, started getting developing a pretty good network of people to talk to in the industry, demonstrating games to publishers. I always did it at conventions. You guys have kind of the same advantage I do in being relatively close to both Origins and Gen Con. Mm-hmm. And so I make those every year. And on pitch games, I've designed quite a few, all about the same weight. I'm never going to design a really heavy Euro game, so Grabwell is about the weight I'm ever, you know, that I like to work. And came close a few times. Had publishers seriously thinking about things, and then it just didn't fit in the schedule and one thing and another. And then I came up with a different game that was called One Way Out, but that's history. It's not really important. But the interesting thing about it was the scoring mechanism on it. I was using a track similar to what you'd see on a cribbage board, right? Just a linear track. And I started to think about how your place in the game, you know, how far along you've got in terms of score. How could that be interesting if it was relative to the other players? If you had more of a lead, then you would might have some disadvantage, or if you were way behind. And other things, or other models, kind of started playing in my head about that, and the idea of gravity kind of just cropped up among all those other models, and that just kind of stuck. And in playtesting, people were more intrigued by that scoring mechanism than they were about anything else in the game. So I just jettisoned the rest of the game, and came up with as simple a game as you could play using that that movement mechanism. Mm-hmm. And that's how Grabwell was born. And then in 2013, I brought it to Gen Con, and I pitched it to a number of publishers. Four of the publishers took it, that's kind of exceptional. That doesn't happen too often. And the following week, I sent just follow up letters to say thanks for listening, or thanks for paying attention, and here's my contact information if you need anything else, yada yada, just a courtesy letter. And Cryptozoic responded the same day, and they just said, we want it. So wow. So that was it. So that was the first, that was the first big breakthrough for me. I talk about doing Kermit arms,
nice.
Yeah. I was alone in a hotel room down south someplace, and I was just kind of dancing around, making a fool of myself all to myself. And nobody would ever know that if I hadn't talked about it.
You're on the Mildly Alarming podcast. Nobody will know it now.
Yes. Yes.
They're going to tune in because we have Corey Young on our podcast, Tom.
Fair enough. It's interesting that you say kind of one of the impetuses of the mechanic was, if you're way ahead, you have some kind of disadvantage. It reminds me a little, now that I think of it, of like Mario Kart with the blue shells.
Yeah, yeah.
How, you know, you get well ahead and then all of a sudden you're getting bombarded with these things from the back. So but it's almost like a fixed version of that kind of mechanic.
Yeah. And when you start studying this stuff, and if you read the books on game design, they call that punishing the leader. And usually that's not actually in the rules. People just do it. They see, mm-hmm. You've got all the chips, so I'm going to beat on you. Right. And I don't care for that. I don't care for the idea of punishing someone for excelling, for doing well. Nor do I like the idea of just giving a handout to somebody who's trailing or is playing poorly. And the mechanism in Grabwell really kind of skirts that. It's just, you guys are entangled. That's the word I like to use, is entangled. Mm. You depend on each other. Nobody's getting out of here alone. Right. Mm-hmm. Until the very end, obviously.
Right.
I like it. Cause you often hear the blue shell in Mario Kart. I don't know if you're familiar with Mario Kart.
I am played many times. And
yeah.
Yeah. The bananas and the, yes. I like to play Wario.
So. Nice. Good heavy character. The blue shell is what we would call mitigation. It's basically there intentionally to level the playing field, so a standout leader doesn't get way ahead and a terrible loser doesn't lag behind quite so much, and it feels very much like what it is. It's shoehorned in intentionally to do exactly that, where your mechanic, it's very organic. It's just like, well, yeah, that makes sense. That's sort of how this gravity, you know, attraction and expulsion, or that's not the word I wanted, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's how that works. I really like it. I think it works out very well. I rarely feel in this game like, oh man, I'm way behind. I'm never going to catch up. Good thing there's this thing someone stuck in at the last second, so losers don't lose so bad. It's very organic and it fits together really nicely.
Right. And the key thing there is that all the players are playing by the same rules.
Yeah.
There are no special rules for somebody who's behind and no special rules for anybody who's ahead. That's what I was really going after. The exception to that is the draft order.
Yeah.
The only exception there is the draft order. And that's really just, I was focusing on the end game. And if somebody is, you know, close to the end and they can draft the purple cards, the repulsion cards, you know, they're going to win. So we had to have a way of mitigating that.
Mm-hmm. Now, the draft mechanic is kind of, it's always been kind of interesting to me. It's pretty unique. It's not something you see in a lot of games. Kind of, could you tell us a little bit about how that came about, how you decided to attach that to the movement mechanic?
Yeah, the drafting, which when we moved by the way, the game is now published by Renegade Games. Renegade, they don't like to use the word spun off, but they spun off from Cryptozoic and took their favorite titles with them.
You could say they budded, maybe?
Yes, blossomed or something.
Yeah, nice.
I just think that Scott Gitt is the owner and president of Renegade. He just has a great eye for games. Of course, I'm going to say that. Anyway, when we spun that off, I was very glad to go to Renegade. Cryptozoic treated me very well, and Renegade treats me very well as well. So, anyway, we changed the name from drafting to mining. So again, big deal. It's just semantics, but it's conceptually that's what you're supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
You were asking about the mechanism itself for the mining, shall we say. For those unfamiliar with it, you deal out piles of cards, and it's just a pile of two cards, typically. And, it's one card face down, one card face up. So you'll draft two cards, one of which everybody will see you draft. So they will know one of the cards in your hand, and then another one face down, so they won't know the other half. That particular mix came out of the development that happened while at Cryptozoic. I had a number of different draft mechanisms proposed, including that one, but a lot of them had piles of different numbered cards or different numbers of cards. There was a pile of one, a pile of two, and a pile of three. There were just quite a few. And they were all more complicated than the draft we ended up with. I always like going simpler, and I'm really glad we came on that one. So what you end up doing, you draft three times like that. Each person, you go around the table, and each person drafts a pile of two cards, and you repeat that three times until you have a hand of six cards, half of which, if anybody was paying attention, half of which everybody knows, and half of which they don't. So we like that. We like the balance on that, and most people do. We've done some variations on it for players who like something a little bit more strategic, or people who are real into card counting. You can play with fully revealed, where all the cards are dealt out in piles. There's still piles of two, but they're two cards face up. So they call that the no secrets option. So you know what everybody has the potential of doing. And some people like to play that. I don't really care.
Would they take that even to open hand, or is it just open mining? And then once it's in your
hand,
good
luck
remembering.
Yeah, it's just open mining, which to me, that's not horribly interesting because it's...
Sure.
The open hand, that you still want to have always the secret of, you know, the reveal. Everybody putting their card out at the same time.
Yeah.
And if you're playing open hand, that just wouldn't work. I think you see the value of that.
Yeah.
In a bit, we can talk about the expansion that's coming because it has a new type of mining that's really fast. So we can talk about that in a bit.
Yeah, I'm excited actually because we tried to. Like I said, we said, what would you do differently or what would you add? And we came up with a couple ideas. I was saying, I like the derelicts and I would like to see them do more, but I don't know that it would necessarily add anything to the game. Like, I don't know that the game needs it necessarily. It could add something. So I'm excited to see what you as the designer would actually do with an expansion.
Well, I do want to hear your ideas. It's still in flux. You know, we're still tweaking things on the expansion. The derelicts. I've always kind of wanted to do something a little bit more with the derelicts too. And one of the things that we had thought about was one of the ships having the ability to remotely nudge a derelict.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, you're right. And just kind of breathe a little life into it, so it can move something that would give you an advantage. We aren't currently including that, but that's the type of thing we think about.
I like the derelicts thematically so much. I want more of them, even though I know that would inherently kind of break the raw mechanics of the game. It would put too many things in there to move stuff around with. I just like them so much that my brain goes so far beyond the mechanics of the game. I'm like, well, a derelict spaceship is terrifying. Like, what's on there? What used to be there? What could you explore? What could you find? A derelict spaceship is just like a mine of its own for content.
Yeah. I'm with you. I like that type of thinking in terms of the theme. And I echo it. What I love is several players. I've just been playing with them and they never call them derelicts. They call them reavers.
Oh, nice.
Awesome.
Yeah, right? And they just came on it on their own. And as it happens, I'm a brown coat, so, you know, I'm gonna dig that. Originally I had asteroids. But I switched it out to derelicts when I, before the first prototype. But I just thought, you know, an asteroid, big deal. You know, yeah, it's some mass, but who cares? Mm-hmm. But derelict, even though it plays exactly the same way, it's still a little, you know, it makes it a little creepy. Like, oh,
there's some mystique to it.
Yeah. Yeah. And people die doing this. So, yeah. I'm with you on the idea. The idea of having too many derelicts, there are some interesting things that happen. I run the math on these things, and there's some interesting things that start to happen if you have too many objects. The number of ties that you end up with increases, mm-hmm. and it becomes a bit tedious. It just becomes fiddly. And,
yeah, yeah.
So I'm trying to avoid that.
Right. I just had an idea. We pitched a couple ideas at each other, and I think they were pretty tame. And I just came up with one as you were talking that I think is probably too fiddly. But if the derelict, because you're in, you know, it's escape from the ninth dimension. Who knows how gravity is going to affect this derelict spaceship? What if there are certain ones of different colors or whatever that behave differently when hit with an attractor or a repulsor? Or a tractor beam. Like, maybe, you know, you want to use your repulsor by the gray derelict, but stay away from that red one because it doesn't obey the laws of physics that we know. It obeys some laws of physics somewhere, but not ours. But probably too fiddly. Go ahead.
You still want to have the ability to plan your move in a couple seconds, mm-hmm. you know, to think, to be able to do all the analysis. And there's some analysis you have to think about before you play. And I don't want to clutter that space up too much with exceptions, right?
Yeah.
But I get it. You know, I do, you know, and the thing is, it's a curse. I'm always designing little things like that. What if I did this? And the first cut I had at the expansion, I had some special abilities for the ships that they ended up, some of them took place on other people's turns. And first couple of plays, I just hated it. I just hated it. Because you have to be paying so much attention to what everybody else is doing on their turn to think whether you want to jump in or not.
Yeah.
And again, that's just not the idea space, you know, not the thinking space I want to be in.
Mm-hmm.
I have so many ideas bouncing around in my head right now, and I don't want to run out our time. I'd like to hear about the expansion you're working on, whatever you're able to tell us about it.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, if you go ahead on with that, that'd be great.
Oh, now? Sure. I didn't know if we kind of run everything to ground that you wanted to talk about there. Let's start with the draft. Well, the main reason there's an expansion coming is the one thing that I got asked for more than anything with the original game is, I like it. I wish we could play more players. And they want five or six player expansion. And my reaction has originally been, for the first year or so, my reaction was, no, I'm not going to do that. Because can you imagine six ships leaving from the center and, you know, just the chaos, right?
Yeah.
Some people feel it's too chaotic with four. And how are you going to plan your move when you've got all these other ships, you know, right there? So I just said it's a non-starter. I'm not even going to think about it. But I lied, you know. So I thought about a different approach, and that is, what if three ships were in the center trying to get out, and three ships were at the warp gate trying to get in?
Nice.
Ooh.
Right? So the three ships coming in are alien ships. They are trying to return to the ninth dimension, or trying to get back home through the ninth dimension. So what you end up with is two small three-player games at each end. And then in the middle, everything goes crazy. You know, you just imagine everything flying by each other and so on. And your worst nightmare is getting tangled up with the ships that are going the opposite direction.
That's cool.
That is super cool. I want this right now.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. So it is, and that what was interesting there is that spun out a middle school teacher posted something on Twitter that she was playing with her, you know, her class, which I love. And two of the boys in class got it in their heads that their job was not to get out, but it was to prevent anybody else from getting out.
Wow.
Right?
That's a middle school boy move.
It definitely is.
It is, but
at any other age group, that's a jerk move, but for middle school boys, yeah, that's a middle school boy move.
Right. If you don't think of that, we revoke your middle school card, right? Yeah, that's but that got me thinking about, you know, okay, what if they were opposing forces here, opposing things? So none of the rules actually had to change in order to allow this, right? The game plays exactly the same way, a couple exceptions. We get rid of all the derelict ships, so that when you're starting out, the closest ship to you are the ships at the other end. So that's what, you know, that's what's attracting you.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, you talk about space clutter. You just don't want. We take the derelicts out. Some people, I don't know, maybe you want them in there, but I take them out. Had to add more cards. The deck doesn't have enough cards for
six
players to have. So we added enough cards for everybody to have hand of six plus a few more, because some of the special abilities has you swapping out a few cards. The fuel cards are mostly the same. There are, you know, we add another repulsor, another attractor beam, and so on. But we add some dozer beams. Okay.
I don't know what that is, but I'm already excited by the name.
That's trademarked, by the way.
Yeah, okay.
I made it up. But if a tractor beam pulls, then a dozer beam would push.
Okay. Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
Right?
I wasn't sure if it was push or destroy, but push makes more sense in the context of the game.
Yeah, so dozer just pushes people out of the way, right? So it acts. They are numbered one. They are the power. The, you know, the amplitude, if you will, how much they push, is the same as the tractor beams are.
Okay.
So there's now a 1-2 and a 3 tractor beam and a 1-2 and a 3 dozer beam in it. So it will push those cards will push ships away from you. And if you think about that, that has the potential of pushing someone in for a win. I'm actually working on some rules to mitigate that. I don't want you, you know, you've got to play this card because you have no cards left. You play it and it gives somebody else the win. That's just not satisfying.
Right.
So I've got to come up with something special to mitigate that. So I hope that makes it. So that's fun.
That is pretty cool.
Okay. So other things. Well, you, again, six players. That's going to be a heck of a draft, isn't it? Or a heck of a mining phase. So I had to clean up and make the mining phase easier and faster. The way we did that was two changes. One, instead of piles of two, you'll have piles of three. There'll be one card down and two cards up. So you're going to see more of your opponent's cards. And when you're making a decision, you're going to be, you know, you're going to see the A with the F. You know, the A is a good card. F is not a great card, but you want the A enough, so you're going to take it. That those decisions about those two cards together are worth grabbing that pile. So that's going to help a bit. That'll be, well, first of all, you're only drafting twice. You're drafting two piles of three instead of three piles of two.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's a big change. The other change is that rather than being tied to how far you are from the warp gate or from the singularity, however you want to think of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's going to be harder to figure now, isn't it? Because you got to think about each ship and how far it is from its home, from the direction it came from, right? So that just becomes fiddly again. And
right.
I didn't want that with six players. I didn't want that. So we introduce an inert token. It's a hexagon-shaped token. You just place it on the 27 space on the board. The 27 space is exactly the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm calling it the Nye Cloud for right now, in honor of Bill Nye. But,
right.
It doesn't move anything. It just reminds you where the 27 space is. And the way the draft is done now is the player that's closest to it, closest to the halfway point, drafts first.
Okay.
Interesting.
Okay, so yeah. There are rules on tiebreakers and things like that. But anyway, the one closest, it's just simple. It's simpler. And then that player, in addition to drafting first, that player also gets to determine the direction of the draft. So they draft either clockwise or counterclockwise, depending on what that person chooses. And the reason for that is, you know, somebody's close to the warp gate. You don't want them to get the purple cards. So you have the draft go the other direction. You have the draft go away from that person so they can't get the purple cards. But the reason I got away from proximity was with six players, you just, okay, who's closest? And again, it just became fiddly. Mm-hmm. I wanted the draft to be faster. So,
well, that cloud idea, it's neat because you start to, as you close in on the middle of the board, you're picking up advantage, drafting earlier, but then you cross this border and all of a sudden you're starting to give up what you did. So it creates kind of an interesting ebb and flow of how good you're doing over the course of the game. That's neat.
That's right. It is an advantage in the early rounds and a disadvantage in the later rounds to be close to that cloud. Yeah. And that the whole idea is to never let the person who's closest to winning draft first. And it serves that purpose.
So you've maintained a victory condition of whoever gets effectively at this point home first wins now?
Yeah.
If the we'll call them aliens, the ones coming from the warp gate get home first,
mm-hmm.
they win. Rather, yep. So it's not, you know, three and three and, you know, pass each other, ships passing in the night, who cares? We just want to get there. We want to get there first.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And people are going to house rule that. I mean, they already house rule that, you know, that whoever, you know, the, a lot of people house rule that they keep playing after one person's escaped.
Well, that's not even a house rule anymore with the version we have. That's in the rule book.
What, that you keep playing?
Yeah, it's in the rule book as a like an additional.
Oh, an alternate rule.
An alternate rule.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, you know, that's fine. And that's cool.
I had a question about so you. With 3-on-3, how do you fix, because we've come up with ideas like this and kind of abandoned them because not necessarily with your style of game, but games where now you've got 3-on-3, but if you don't have 6 people, you can't really do 3-on-2.
You can. Yeah, it works.
Does that work with yours?
Yeah, it does work. My recommendation is you can play Gravwell with two players, right? It is not balanced per se, but okay. I would say it's negligible. And I would recommend that the more experienced players play on the side that only has two.
Uh-huh. But you let it go. You're not like don't do that because it's not balanced and it needs to be balanced. You
just No. Don't
come out with it.
No, it works. Huh. It works. It's you know, you just make a note, it's a little harder. But it can be done.
Well, I like you keep coming back to this, talking about your design and then your design of the expansion that you're trying to keep it simple. And we always talk about keeping it simple. We're really terrible at keeping it simple. We tend to design games that balloon kind of out of control very quickly. And sometimes it gets to a point pretty quickly where it's clear the game's just not going to work the way it is. And we are often unwilling to simplify, and sometimes we simplify a little, but we love our exceptions. We talked to some designers at Protospiel. I don't know if you've ever been to
Protospiel. Yeah, I have. I love it. I hope to go every year, but I missed last year.
Yeah, so. We got a lot of great input on our game that we're working on. One of the one that is furthest along in development right now at Protospiel this last summer. And but yeah, we love exceptions. We heard at Protospiel, what is it, the general,
the player can generally remember two exceptions.
It's just two exceptions, and beyond that, it's just that is where fiddly happens.
Yeah, I think. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a bit of a variation on, I'm going to call it Engelstein's law.
Okay.
For Jeff Engelstein. Where he's talking about mechanisms that never give anybody more than two new mechanisms because it just, you know, they gotta have something to cling to. But no, I get that. I think that makes sense. I agree with the point that you don't want to, give too many exceptions, for one player to think about.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Do you find that something that you do in design? You're the one saying, hey, I need this to be simple, or is that something you put an idea forward and a publisher or whoever you're working with says, hey, that might be a little too much for a player to take on, and they have to kind of encourage you to pare it down a little bit?
I guess I preempt it. I know they're going to talk to me about it. I know that I'm going to hear it from the publisher. So I kind of preempt the conversation by just simplifying it myself. Because I'm always a bit afraid of how they're going to simplify it. that it's not going to be a way.
Better
that
do it
I
my
would,
way first rather than. Yeah. Them
yeah.
For,
I'd rather
the
have,
point.
You're, I'd rather give them a few options to, from which to choose than, yeah, just trust them to. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's pretty obvious. So,
if you don't mind, I have to use the restroom really badly. If I could pause for a second and we'll come back. I've got a few more questions for you. Is that okay?
Yeah, of course.
All right, I'll be right back.
Are we keeping that in the show?
No.
The bathroom break?
No. Oh.
Okay. Come on.
I guess I could. Depends on how quick I pee.
Hello, I'm Melvin Tuckle. I can't afford very much commercial code to my store called Tuckle's Buckles. I want to buy your buckles. I'll cut them right off your pants. I am out of time. Goodbye.
All right. You still with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Excellent. I'm good. Thank you. we've only got about 10 minutes left here. I feel like there's enough meat on this next topic that we could probably do a whole second show with you if you're interested. But we talked a bit recently on Twitter about colorblind designing for people who are colorblind, designing as a person who is colorblind. Mm-hmm. We have a friend who plays with us regularly who's colorblind, and we are always sort of trying to keep him in mind as we design with color choices for player pieces, for cards, just trying to make it so that everyone has equal access to the game and there's not a benefit given to people who can see the entire color spectrum. And our friend Alphonse is just sitting over there being like, I don't know what you guys are talking about. And you mentioned on Twitter that you have experienced similar problems. We talked a little bit about the design of your game and kind of being reliant on the artist or the designer, or not that you're the designer, but the visual designer. I just wanted to talk to you about that a little bit if you have time.
Sure. First of all, the color choices and things like that, I know that those, I'm not self-publishing. So right. I know that that's going to go to a talented professional who will make those decisions. In the case of Gravwell, for example, I saw comps. I didn't have any approval rights or anything like that with Gravwell in terms of the graphic design for it. Mm-hmm. But they were very courteous and kept me in the loop the whole time. Just, what do you think of this? How's this look? And so on. And I never had any. I only had positive things in terms of comments. The colors that they chose for the fuel cards, I found them interesting. There was enough contrast in them. I could tell them apart. Mm-hmm. I have a type of color vision or color deficiency called protanopia. Mm-hmm. And it basically means I don't see red the way you guys see red.
Right.
It's just a hole in the spectrum. I just don't see it well. And, even so, if you put on some red glasses right now, mm-hmm. Red tinted glasses, and you looked at the three fuel cards in Gravwell, you'd be able to tell them apart. You'd be able to see. Now I'm glad they also put on symbols, because a very small percent. I'm a subset of a subset already. I'm a very small percentage of the people who are colorblind. I've got one of the worst. One of the worst types, mm-hmm. but the worst type would be those who only see in black and white, just monochromatic. That's the exception to the exception. It's very, very rare. So those people would, you'd have to differ the hue, in addition to, the color for them to be able to see it at all. But we use symbols as well. So the mm-hmm. cards have pretty obvious symbols to indicate, what it is they do. And it's a nice reminder for everybody that you can tell what the card does based on its symbol. So that's helpful. My only challenge with the colors that they chose is, the first time I tried teaching Gravwell, I talked about these yellow cards and these teal cards and these blue cards. Now, the yellow are actually green. The normal fuel cards are bright green. And,
yeah.
But I thought they were yellow.
They're a very yellow green.
Yeah.
Even for me.
The teal, I guess I got right, which is it's a green, a blue, but bluish green, whatever.
Yeah.
Which that's my understanding what teal is. But most people call them blue. A lot of people call the tractor beam cards blue.
Yeah.
But the cards I was calling blue are actually purple.
Yeah, you said on Twitter that they look navy blue to you.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So it's funny. I can discern them. I can tell them apart. I just can't tell you what color they are, right? I don't. So I have to think. I have to think what color those are, right? There are some funny things. Like, I just found out couple of years ago that I'm trying to remember what there was one that really struck me. I want to say it was a Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just drawing a blank right now. But there was some big obvious thing that everybody knows that I didn't know. Well, like in Schindler's List, for example.
The roses are red in an otherwise black and white film, and you can't see red, so that's it just looks like a black and white film.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. So those sorts of things, right? Anyway, I think about it in terms of game design, that I don't want the color to convey meaning. Mm-hmm. That red means conflict and things like that. Now, that has an emotional connection. You know, if you play Seven Wonders, the red cards are the conflict cards. I don't associate those colors with that meaning, because I have to interpret the colors. I have to think about them. Mm-hmm. I have to concentrate in order to figure out what color some things are. And it better be, I need good lighting too, by the way. So where a person could look at a field of, let's say, meeple, you know, you have, mm-hmm. you look at a pandemic board or a Carcassonne board or something like that. If one person can look and see, okay, red owns a lot of this area and green owns a lot of this area, and they just get a sense of that because they can see, they see clumps of red. Mm-hmm. I have to look and concentrate on each little meeple there and say, is that one green or that one red? That green, red, red. And make that differentiation. You know, that's an advantage to the person who has normal color vision.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you are what I've heard red green called red green colorblind.
Yes.
And I know that's a sort of an oversimplification, but
I'm not sensitive. You know, I'm not sensitive about it.
Yeah. So but even scientifically speaking, it's not a particularly meaningful descriptor, since there are various different kinds of color deficiencies that can't distinguish red from green. But
if we were to,
because this is what we try to do, and you've kind of opened my eyes a little bit to maybe this not even being all that helpful, and using shapes and symbols in addition to colors to try to level things a little bit might be a good idea. But if we were to go, I think what we usually try to do is red, blue, black, yellow.
Yes, but if the, for me, and mm-hmm. again, other people are colorblind different ways, for me, because I don't see red, red goes very dark. Mm-hmm. Actually, like displays that have red LEDs or red indicators against a black background uh-huh. are nearly impossible for me to read.
Wow.
So black can go to red. I mean, red can go to black, I mean.
Really?
Yeah, weird, right?
Yeah.
Well, if you think about it, if you can't see red, you know, my eyes are not picking up the red light that is being projected
reflected.
At them.
Yeah.
So it's just saying, no, that's black.
Okay.
There's no light coming from that, so that's black.
I was expecting you to say, you know, a red and a... That, you know, there's aspects of red and yellow, or yeah. blue isn't necessarily true blue. So it's
right.
it's and those are confusing. But red and black, okay.
That's... As long as red is a bright red, bright red. But if it's a muddy or like a dark burgundy or something like that, uh-huh. a muddy red, then it's gonna go.
But even if you can distinguish, it's gonna take some concentration. You can't look at it and go that's a different shade of
right.
grayish,
yes.
whatever.
Yeah,
it is.
Yes. But again, that's all the people inside Corey's skull see it that way. Yes.
Yeah, that's yeah. really interesting.
Yeah, and by the way, you just listed the colors of the ships in Gravwell.
Yeah, sort of.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of funny. The ships, everything in Gravwell seems to sort of avoid, and we talked about this when we talked on Twitter too, avoid primary colors. Like the blue is a very blue green, the red is a very kind of purpley pinkish red. The yellow is like a banana yellow, not a CMYK true yellow.
I'll
like black is the only thing in these ships that is actually just the color that it says it is.
I have to take your word.
Yeah, and it's funny because for you, those are probably differences that don't matter.
Yeah.
For me, those are colors that I'm like, can I call that red? It's kind of pinkish.
Yeah,
and like it's not an important distinction because I can see the difference, but for communicating the difference, it becomes complicated.
It's funny the things you just kind of give up trying to perceive and trying to fight. When last year, when they, I guess it was just this year, when everybody was talking about the dress,
yeah.
The color. My reaction, I think everybody who's colorblind, their reaction is, the dress is whatever color you tell me it is. I don't care.
That's awesome.
I know it's broken. You know, I know I don't see it. So whatever. If you say it's blue, fine, I believe you. You say it's something else, sure, that's it.
Wow.
Yeah, you stop caring.
Well, I'd love to talk to you more about this, and maybe we can have you on another time, because I think there's a lot to be explored in. And we've talked to a few other people about it before, just accessible design.
And I'm a big proponent of that. To give an example of two negative examples that people are probably pretty familiar with, the Firefly board game, the big humongous Firefly board game. I was really excited about that 2 years ago when it came out. And I went by the booth at Gen Con and took one look and said, nope, not for me, can't do it. The ships were all just too, I can tell there were multiple, you know, collections of ships, but the colors were all just way too close. And there was no way I was going to be able to pick them apart.
Oh, that's a shame.
And then Quirkle, the Spiel des Jahres winner Quirkle. Interesting little abstract game. But the colors on that are just way too close. I can't tell them. So, and people say, well, they have shapes. Yes, and the shapes have a separate meaning from the color. It's not the same. So it just doesn't work.
There's a I'm blanking. I'm digging through my Twitter right now trying to find it, and I'm still not. There's a guy out there. I think a person out there who does board game modifications for blind people.
I was trying to think of the same. It's killing me that it's not coming to me either.
I'll put it in the show notes. We've talked to him and talked about him on the air too.
But. Yeah, just he makes the sleeves and the dice. He's doing 3D printed dice.
Yeah.
And I'm all for that. It's a shame that some games are just not going to be suitable for it, but. But yeah, some games just aren't. You can't just reach out and touch all the cards.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, we'd love to talk to you about it more another time if you're up for it.
You bet.
Thanks. But we got to wrap it up here. Is there anything you want to plug? I don't know if you got your expansion coming out. Anything else you're working on, or your own podcast, or Twitter, or anything else you got to push?
Rap album.
No, I really appreciate it. I think I've pushed pretty hard on the, I don't know if I pushed, but I was happy to talk about the expansion. That'll be coming out from Renegade. We're in the playtesting phase of that right now. There's a game I've been working on for a while called Santorini, and we're probably going to be kickstarting that one, and maybe I'll reach out to you before that, so we can talk about that. No, everything other than that, I just been really enjoying your podcast. It's the right mix for me of thinking about games, but also the levity. A lot of other podcasts could learn a lot about just lighten it up, you know.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate it. It's just the right tone for me. It's probably because I grew up in Port Huron, actually.
Just
up the road from you guys, so I got the same sensibilities and. I find that I think we have a lot of overlap in our cultural experience in terms of geek culture too. So, yep.
Cool. Well, if you want to get in contact with Corey on Twitter, he's at C_M_Young. And you know where to find us on Twitter at Mildly Alarming.
On email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
And on the web, on our website at mildlyalarming.com, in the comment section. We're also on iTunes. We're on Stitcher. We will shortly be on Google Play Music. And we're on, what's the other thing? TuneIn Radio.
Sure.
You can comment in most, but not all of those places.
We're also at the bottle of all bottles of liquor. Bottle. Bottom. Wow. Had too much gin tonight.
You've had
we're good.
One G&T. Lightweight.
I'm a tiny man.
It's true.
Thanks for being on the show, Corey. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks. Have a great night. Thanks.
You too. Bye-bye.
Everybody has an old cabinet full of china in their house, but sometimes china isn't all that nice. Don't you sometimes wish that you had better china than you do? I know I do. My name's Agnes Crinklehorn, and I was born in 1897, and I'm the founder of Agnes Crinklehorn's Fine China. By purchasing our products, you can be sure you'll have the best china, not the crummy kind that has air full of particulate matter and sometimes rounds up dissidents and ships them off to re-education camps. No! Our fine china is the china that has that great big wall to keep the Mongolians out, or those soldier fellows made of terracotta that got buried. Agnes Kringlehorn's Fine China. For when crummy china just won't do.